So can you just start by saying your name and what your current position is?
I'm Yijun Wang, and currently I'm a research scientist at the University of Oxford. I'm a PhD student, and I am also an employee at Perspectum, which is the founder who found me to do my PhD. And I am a research scientist at the innovation team right now.
Right. So going back to how you first got interested in science, can you just talk me through the stages of your education and career up to the point where you first came to Oxford?
Oh, wow. Okay. Even before I came to Oxford?
Oh, yes. From where, how did you first decide you were going to
do a science degree? Right. That's a good question. I think since I was young, I was always interested in the subject of like math, and then I really like to know how things work. Specifically, when I approach a new object, I will ask about how. So how does that make sense? How does that come into play? Throughout my educational journey, I like a lot of hands-on type of experience. So I like chemistry. I like math, I like experiment, and I knew that I would do a science degree, science-based degree. And I chose to be really specialized in medical imaging and radiology science from my undergrad in when I was back in Taiwan. And that was at that time I wasn't really sure about the decision at that time, but I knew very well I want to do in a medicine-related type of science, so either radiology. I applied to pharmacology as well. There's another called, I think it's biochemistry. And I applied for a medicine degree, but obviously I didn't get it. Yeah, at that time you can apply to six when I was back in Taiwan, choosing to do a degree in medical science. And I got full scholarship for the radiology science degree, and so I chose that. That was a 3 years very hardcore science course, and then
very practically oriented.
So the fourth year is very practical because we do internship actually at sites in hospitals. So at that time I was at the National Taiwan University Hospital for the fourth year of my undergrad, and I basically shadow our radiographers on sites, and I was running through various departments, but then mainly in diagnostic radiology. And another one is nuclear medicine, and another one is radiation therapy, specifically at the treatment side. And there are others like bits and pieces like ultrasound and dental X-ray. Mm.
So were you doing X-ray and MRI and ultrasound?
That's one of the good things that's really, I found it really interesting back in Taiwan. We do various modality. So I can run ultrasound, I can run CT, I can run X-ray. Dental X-ray, MRI, and this therapy side is the linear accelerator. Yeah, it was like a high energy machine. Mm. So that's an interesting bit. I believe here in the UK, people probably choose to be specialized to a specific type of modality. Mm. Yeah, mm. Yeah, radiological science. I finished my clinical training and get back, I got the national exam, which is just basically you qualifying to be a radiographer, to be able to work as a radiographer. That's the national exam. So I finished that exam and I started thinking about, I actually really wasn't sure that I want to just start working clinically. So I decided to apply to various universities, and at that time I was really interested in radiotherapy and like the treatment side, specifically that comes out from a radiology degree. So I applied to six universities in the UK to do a master's degree, and at that time I really wasn't putting much hope into like whether I'll get into Oxford or not. I would just, since I'm preparing, might as well just submit an application to Oxford. And then it turned out I got accepted, and I was interested. At the time, was actually Lunar New Year. I got the information saying that, hey, you're accepted to do a master program in Oxford. And like, I was in a car with my parents who were just like shouting in the car. We were so happy. Yeah, so I decided to study a little bit more. So I came to Oxford in 2018, and that was a degree in radiation biology. So it's far more, I would say, niche and specialized, because you kind of look at a combination of biological science and physics together. And that in the program itself, I could also feel it was a very multidisciplinary team and multidisciplinary cohort. And I was the only Asian student within the cohort, and all the others had like, they were either European or American student. And my understanding at that point of time, that specific program was also like very, you know, like there were very few Asian students before. So I joined, and most other people do biology, and I did like more like physics, math type of degree as an undergrad. So people came with a like different background. It was six of us. We were super, super tight. We worked together. We traveled together. That's at that time I really enjoyed my master's degree.
Mostly a taught program, or did you do some research?
So it was a 13-month program. So we get taught for the first two terms, and then the second half of the second term and the last term, we did a short project, a research project. So at that time, I was really lucky to be part of the medical physics group in the oncology department. And that was, my supervisor was Frank van der Hovel, who's Belgian. He left Oxford after I graduated from my master's degree. Yeah, so I did a research project with them, specifically looking at a type of technical stereostatic radiotherapy. It was roughly like a 6 months period of time, and we will write up our thesis, our dissertation, and then do a viva. So it's very compact, a really stressful degree, actually, I have to say. it was very intense, but also fun. It was probably the best year of my life here in Oxford. So that's about me. And then after I graduated from my master's degree, I wasn't really sure what to do. I was lost. I was the definition of lost. in the cohort, most of my other peers, they went back to the US to start their medicine degree, which is interesting to know, actually. Mm. Yeah, they have a first degree and then to do a medicine degree. And then the other two had all got like PhD position lined up before they even graduated. So I was the only one who left with like no job, no further plan. I was really, really, really lost.
And did you go home at that point?
I went home. Yeah, I went home during the junction when I submitted my dissertation and waiting for my viva. So I came back for my viva.
So we're at the end, towards the end of 2019. Right?
Towards the end of 2019.
Yes.
At that time. I finished my viva in September. Oh, and then I went back home, actually. And I came back for the graduation in November.
Right.
Yeah, so it was very end of 2019. Mm. Yeah, and I came back for the graduation. And that time, my visa sort of allowed me to stay all the way until like March 2020. So there was a grace period. And so I utilized those periods to start to find jobs, finding internship, finding new like opportunities. And then I came in contact with Perspectum. I approached Perspectum and I asked them if I can do an internship with them. And they saw my background. I was like, okay, you can come and do an internship with us. Yeah, so that's
so you
how
went,
I joined.
So I think what Banjo told me was that you were planning to do a PhD.
I was planning. Yeah, so I was finding like either internship as an interim option, but I also was like trying to apply to like many different PhD positions. I got into to the oncology PhD in Oxford.
I see. Yes.
Yeah, I did.
Yes.
So, but then there was no funding, so I didn't carry on. An internship became available. I decided, okay, that's also a good opportunity for me to gain some like industrial experience and really try to like do basically like work, you know, as opposed to just study.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so I think we've got, and that was going to take you through to March, was it? That was
the
plan.
It would
take you through to March.
Take me through to March.
But then, of course, as we all know, so can you remember when you first heard that there was a nasty respiratory infection spreading in China and how you came to realise that was going to have a bit of an impact on your life?
I really wasn't sure how to respond at that time. So I just started my internship and I started to get to know about like my colleagues and my manager here in Perspective. And there were so many things to learn when you first join an organization. There are also lots of policies to read. So it was a very, like, I was trying to absorb as much as I can. And when I first heard about the outbreak, I was really not sure how to respond. I didn't necessarily worry about that, honestly. I was just really focusing on, like, starting off properly for my career at that point of time. So I really didn't think that much when I first hear about outbreak. And it was, things started to become really dire, really weird in March 2020, I believe, in March 2020. And we had a company meeting where Banjo, which is our CEO, he just brought us to the boardroom and then tell everybody that next day, on a Wednesday, everybody go home, everybody work from home. And everybody didn't know how to respond. The team, like some of the team, because I was a very like hands-on involved team. Like we had physical equipment where we store on here on site at the lab, and we need to like physically come in to transport them. And at that time, everybody was like scrambled trying to find a way to make things work. And I was an intern at that time. There were still a lot of operational procedures that I didn't know. So I was really freaked out. I was pretty much just being blank and then trying to see like what I can do, how I can help. So I can help if I stop like here a little bit, there a little bit. It was pretty frightening at that time. But
and your visa was going to run out at the end of March, is that right?
Yes. Yes, it was about to run out. But luckily at that time I was able to to extend with a different route of visa, which is called TF5, and that's specifically for an internship, for people to do an internship here in the UK. Yeah, so that got extended. So it was, I was very lucky in that sense to be able to do that. And I was really grateful that Perspective at that time helped me out to do that.
Because I mean, would you have been able to go back to Taiwan at that stage, or had flights stopped going?
Yeah, at that time when I was monitoring, I've certainly found it impossible to go back home, mainly because the cost of the flight is just so much. It's really not like some affordable for someone who's just started their career, barely have any saving, earning the internship salary, will be able to afford. So that's really unreasonable. And another thing in my mind at that time, I knew that I just started my career. Do I throw away my career potentially? Because you never know how long the pandemic, and as now that I know, it was a really extended impact. At that time, if I was really thinking, do I throw my career away, or do I choose to stay on the safe side? So like, I was worried about that, like, my career would just stop. My career here in the UK would just stop. And also I was like financially not possible to like escape from the UK. So it was kind of like in a way a very easier decision that I just chose to stay. Yeah, I didn't second guess to like, oh, whether should I go now? That type of thing. I was just also really worried about my future at that point of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the internship was extended.
Was extended.
And you must have begun to feel more comfortable around the company, and yeah, you would have read all the operating procedures and all the rest of it.
I did, so, and I was.
And where did you find your niche in the company?
It's actually really. I wouldn't say I have a niche in the company, not necessarily, but things started to change at the point, I believe, in May 2020, maybe mid-April, early May 2020. At the time, Perspectum started to set up a study called the CoverScan, which is now so-called the long COVID study. And at that time, we want to see like the organ impairment through the effect of COVID. So we basically do an MRI scan, very extensive protocol for supposedly COVID. COVID cases at that time. So yeah, that study was set up, and it was a Perspectum funded study, and we decided to do that, and it was a type of a project where nobody really knew how the long term plan is going to be. But we did it anyway. We thought that, like, hey, we're a medical technology company, we can do something to help, and we had the capacity, had the skill set to be able to support this type of research. So that study got set up really quickly, and I had a radiographer qualification back in Taiwan, and so at that time, apart from just my internship, like original role as an intern at the imaging applications team, I was brought up to the study team to support the scanning of the patients. And it almost to me had like, I just feel like this is like a flashback, and like it was an opportunity for me to like really support as in the general population with a skill set that I had acquired prior before I came to Oxford. And I was at the point where I had like this phase of my life where I was so unsure about where I'm gonna go next in terms of career. And so that study almost came into like, I feel like it saved my life. It saved me from having to make really hard decisions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I joined a team, and then I just started to like scan patients nonstop.
So talk me through how that happened. So was the diagnostic centre that there is here now in the Spectrum offices,
that
hadn't been set up at that
stage?
No,
that hadn't been set up at that stage.
So where were you doing the scanning?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. So the scanning was done by, there is a truck, basically contain a big magnet, an MRI scanner within the truck that just pull into the car park of the building, at the back of the building, and we had that scanner supposed to just sit there, and people, and then we sort of work around the building a route where people will be coming in from one direction and going out from the other direction. And it was really lucky for us because at the ground floor it was pretty much empty at that time, and so we can accept people from the front and then loop them out from the back and come into the truck where they did a scan, and go out from the other side of the truck towards the other direction, and then come into the building to take their blood and then exit the building. And so there's this almost that one in, one out system that was sort of utilized what we had at that time.
And these were people who had recovered from COVID?
Yeah, so.
But did they have ongoing symptoms, or were you just looking at anybody who had recovered from COVID?
Yeah, so it was a very early stage at that time in 2020. Mm. So we, before there's like specific test or like quick antigen testing coming in.
Yeah.
It was about the GP, like the doctors, they were assigned the symptoms. So we'll look at symptoms.
Mm.
And at the time we qualify, I wouldn't say qualify, we include patients where they had like proper, how to say it, like GP diagnosis, say,
yes.
Okay, this is likely, this person's a likely a COVID case.
Yeah.
And then they are brought into the inclusion, they can be included to the CAT scan yeah. study at that time. But then
they were over the acute phase by the time they came to see you, were they?
No, so we actually scan quite a lot of people who they still had difficulty breathing, have difficulty walking this distance, because yeah, it was actually quite big. They had to walk along the way to complete the whole study. We actually scanned quite a few patients. They would describe their symptoms, and it was just really painful to see them had to go through that. But the antigen test coming into play, and then we were able to like use test results. So we did a protocol amendment on the CAT scan study, and therefore we was able to be confident that all the patients we all scanned were all COVID patient.
Mm.
But this doesn't say that like what we did before was not truly right, but it was because we didn't have like tangible measure to be sure.
It was the best you could do.
It was the best that we could do. Mm. Yeah. 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 So that was, we pretty much scanned COVID patients and with a very extensive protocol.
Mm-hmm. And you were the main patient facing person.
Also, they are. So the study team, it consists of quite a few different people. We had like the research nurse, and we also had radiographer, and we also had like the receptionist, the administrative side. So the team, the whole core team were patient facing, and I'm just part of them. And I'm actually like the junior side of part of them. They were very experienced at that time. So I was lucky. I was able to learn how to like properly receive patients, check their safety, check if they're eligible, make sure they're safe on the scanner, make sure they're safe on the route to a different station. It was an amazing experience to be able to learn, but also scary and tiring at the same time. Mm, mm. Yeah.
Mm. So how long a day were you doing?
Yeah, so the scan started off from the earliest was before 8 o'clock, and then we usually finish until sometime late at 7:30 in the evening. Yeah, and every day we would need to shut down the scanner, so that would actually takes quite a bit of time to like wrap things up. And the most tricky part to run a COVID study to run a scan for a COVID patient is that you have to clean like very thoroughly during each visit, and it was really tricky. So we need to find specific equipment that wouldn't interfere with the magnetic field that comes out from the MRI scanner. And we needed to use this equipment to like really clean the inner border. So it was a bit hilarious now looking back. Yeah.
But hard work, and just like a kind of machine, one yeah. after the other.
Yeah, so yeah. You rotate cases like one at a time. And the most we can do was 8 patients at that time.
Mm.
For one day, mm-hmm. because it was a 40-minute scan, and depending on how well the patient feel about like being in the scanner and the setup, so it's actually quite time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So the most we could do was probably 8 people, occasionally we will extend to like late at night to help finish the demand. But yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was like that. We had two radiographers. They started off, which was my senior colleagues at that time. They started off, and then I joined, and then we brought up a few other people to help support the demand. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just to go over it again, I mean, I did talk to Banjo mm-hmm. about this, but the point about the cover scan mm-hmm. Technology was that you were essentially scanning the whole patient's
basically the
torso,
whole body. Whole torso. So
yes.
we scan from the how to say, you can say from the neck all the way down to almost covering their knee. So basically the whole torso, like the abdominal and the chest region of the patient. Yeah.
And then the software part of it was looking at six organs.
Yeah. So we have heart metrics. At that time, lung was relatively new. That's also like a new metric that we really need to start ramped up. Pancreas, liver, and kidney.
Five.
Kidneys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. These five. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Perspectum started off as a like very specialized in liver
yes.
technology. But the R&D side of Perspectum, we always have people from various different backgrounds who they used to look at either cardiac, like the heart, or they used to look at kidney disease. And so at that time, people was being really creative to support new metric, new analysis. That came in during the COVID time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a stressful period for the whole organization, and people were really helping each other out. Yeah.
So as well as collecting data that hadn't been collected before, mm-hmm. the software itself was evolving.
It was evolving.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and to a degree it really just sort of let us know how much we could do as an organization. And to an extent, it also like creates lots of innovation, yeah. And also like because the way people work, like everybody work remotely, it also creates new type of collaborative procedure, yeah, among the group. Yeah, it was actually at some point very productive if we were, everybody was working from home at that time. Yeah.
So, oh, yes, okay. So you were obviously here with the truck.
I was here with the truck, yeah.
But all your
yeah, the rest
software
of the
colleagues
team,
were all at home.
Yeah, they were away, yeah.
Yes,
well.
So mm-hmm. how often did you link up with them on virtually? Did you have meetings
yeah,
every
so
day?
We have weekly meetings.
Weekly meetings.
And then we will update each other on the issues on site and the coordinators. There will be coordination sites who actually receive patients' information, screen them, and then give them information on like when to arrive at the site. So we will have like weekly meetings with them and had an update about each like specific area on the study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the analysis side of the cover scan study that happens in parallel as well, but they have their study which I wasn't necessarily being part of. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how long did this intense period last?
Oh, I can't remember. Intense period. It had always been quite intense.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. I mean, did it go over into 2021, or was it just...
Yeah, it did go over into 2020. So the cover scan study formally finished at the... Yeah, very close to the end of 2021.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so very close to the end of 2021 to basically make sure that, okay, we set out like the number of patients that we need to require to make it statistically powered enough for us to make judgment. So, like, the whole recruitment and... finalizing analysis was probably done like late 2021, and the intense period was was probably throughout 2020.
Mm.
Yeah,
mm.
throughout 2020 was the whole period was very intense.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so once the study was completed, what was your next move?
What was our next move? End of 2021, I was really hoping to start my PhD actually. So alongside running this cover scan, I was applying to PhD position and I got into the engineering engineering department from Oxford. And but then in 2021, I couldn't start at that time. So I kind of just pushed that aside, I was really lucky because in Oxford they allow you to defer for a year, so I was able to do that, and then I just focused on supporting like the existing work, like the backlog actually type of responsibility in perspective at the original team, which was image implications team, yeah. So at that time, I was supporting them writing up documentations. And these documentations are specific protocols that's set up on a trial cases, on like trial, when I say trial, it means like clinical trials.
Mm.
Yeah, and so each of these clinical trials, they want a set of guidelines, a set of protocol, a set of imaging acquisition instructions. So I would be tailoring those instructions based on the trial requirement. So that was like the technical writing side of my role at that time. And it was honestly also a very valuable skill to have, which I didn't necessarily get taught back at school. And so that was very hands-on and very real-world experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To be able to support technical documentation and with like so many different variations across trials, we kind of need to be very creative with the way that we write documentation. So we adopt new software and actually learn different type of structuring technique. So it was a very like software-based, technical, and then knowing, understand how to utilize databases in that case, and also do proper version control of the documentation. So that was relatively new to me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so I basically the whole year of 2021 to 2020, end of 2020, yeah, I was focusing on supporting the technical documentations for the image applications team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you got a place to do a PhD in engineering. So had you changed your thinking? Because when you were originally going to go for one in oncology.
In oncology, yeah.
Had you already sketched out what you thought the problem you were going to investigate was, and did that change for your the engineering place?
As in like the question, like
yes.
the study,
yes.
the topic of the research?
Yes.
Yeah, it did change along the way, and it wasn't necessarily just about like interest, the change of interest on my end. I was also like considering the fact that like my supervisor, who I was with and during my master's degree, he left Oxford.
Yes.
And I thought about it and I had like advice from the senior scientists and also my supervisor here in perspective. I sort of asked them like what would be the good research topic to do further down the line. And so they kind of shape my research interest in a bit. But what made me choose to apply to engineering, it was because I was specifically really interested in this person's work, which is my current supervisor, Daniel Borty, in mm-hmm. IBME, the Institute of Biomedical Engineering. I was really interested in his research. So mm-hmm. I approached him, I wrote my proposal, I had a few discussions with him, and we continued to do that almost throughout 2021 to 2022. Yeah. He was also a very supportive person who sort of like carried me through the last bit of pandemic, and also like carried me where I was probably second year into my career, wasn't really sure what I was supposed to do in terms of being a scientist. So like he gave me a bit of guidance along with all the colleagues here in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, Perspectum has quite strong links with the engineering department.
It
anyway,
does, yeah,
it,
so, it yes, does, yes. It does, it really does. And then, that's probably why became into.
So, what is your thesis topic? What did you choose to work on?
So currently, So my thesis topic is hopefully using a Bayesian network to support the decision making on liver cancer, primary liver cancer. And now I'm first year in, the research focus is gearing towards the treatment selection side. So
Can you explain that a bit better for someone who doesn't have a background in statistics?
So in liver cancer, so the treatment, there are many different options for treating liver cancer, primary liver cancer. You can do surgery, you can do transplant, you can also do something called ablation, which is sticking a rod into and then basically burn the tumor cells out, ablation, and some other thing called embolization. So you sort of like use like this little beads to block out the vascular structures for the tumor, and there's also radiotherapy, which is using radiation to treat the tumor cell itself. The field and the practice of liver cancer treatment is very varied. It's very non-standardized across the world. And for this treatment, specific for this disease, we had guidelines. In America has their own guideline. Europe has their own guideline. Asia has a set of guidelines. And within Asia, there are also like different countries has their own guidelines. So it's a very widespread field. And the tricky part is there's no way to like properly compare which one is more effective than the other. When it comes to treatment, there are many other options that came into play, in many other factors that came into play than just the patient's diagnostic results.
Yeah.
So it also comes with like if they will respond well to the treatment, if these patients has like enough financial support to support them to be able to go through the treatment. Or like complications that might come into play. And so it's very messy as a route. And so my research really is about using Bayesian network to be able to make these type of comparisons more tangible, more effective.
So you're collecting data from health systems across the world?
Not necessarily across the world, but like currently we have quite a few data set that's like existing in Perspectum, and that's collaboration with like across the UK, and there's some data set in Singapore, some in the US, but I wouldn't say it's very widely covered like all over the world, but it's a good coverage, it's a good starting point.
So it's essentially it's a data analysis project.
Yeah, it is a very data analysis intense project.
Yes. And I've let you slide over Bayesian networks. Mm. I've already asked somebody to explain what Bayesian approaches are, but it's to do with probability.
Yeah, it's to do with probability. Yeah. Yes, exactly. That's a good way to put it. That's the core, actually. The core of Bayesian network is all about probability.
But it's a particular way of looking at probability.
A different way than what people usually do to look at statistics. Mm. Yeah, it's a very distinct type of approach.
And what you hope will come out of this is some kind of clearer idea of the treatment approaches that work best with particular kinds of patients. Yes.
That's the goal. That's the goal, and I have good level of support from a senior PhD student who utilized that technique, and I had good support from Mike, my current supervisor, and I also had good support in terms of data set here in Perspectum. So hopefully we can come up with something that can really make the treatment selection side very personalized. geared towards the patients. And currently, really what I think will be the immediate next step is to hope that there will be some collaborating doctors actually in the clinic. They're happy to like help me, you know, really validate the technology. Yeah.
And you're still working here at Perspectum. How do you manage your time? Are you doing the PhD full time, or are you doing it as a part time?
So I'm doing it full time, but like since I'm in the innovation team, which is a very research scientist type of role, and so that it didn't necessarily go over. I mean the wide. I guess being a research student, the best thing is that you can just read so much, read really broad, try and test things out as much as you can. And here in Perspectum, the innovation team, obviously we have objectives, but like it's also very, how to say it, like it's very liberal.
Yes, I mean quite academic.
Yeah,
it's quite academic environment.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, it had fit in well so far. In terms of like how I manage my time, I really don't know. I'm still learning, and probably I wouldn't say I have a strategy to properly manage my time, but I've found if I schedule more things to do, more various type of things to do, I get more productive. Yeah. So that's my approach. Yeah.
Yes, you need a lot of energy for that.
Yeah.
So I'm just going back to how the pandemic impacted on you personally. How did you feel about it as a disease? Did you feel personally threatened by the possibility that you might be infected? Have you in fact had it?
I did. I did get infected, and actually I get infected, and it was 2022.
So you'd had a vaccine by then, had you?
I had, yeah. Yes. I had like two or three doses of vaccine at that time already. And so I probably caught the strain, the Omicron variant at that time. Yeah, I had the infection at that time. But like before I even had my first dose of vaccination, I wasn't afraid about the disease, honestly. My mind was not about making sure that I was safe. I knew that I had way to protect myself, like wash my hands or like never touch your faces. And when we come in here to do cover scan, we get like proper scrub. We were all covered, and I clean everything before I head back to the house. And in my mind, I really wasn't afraid of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you encounter, and this might be a slightly difficult question, but I interviewed another East Asian Oxford researcher recently,
right.
And she encountered hostility early on in the pandemic,
right.
from ordinary people in the street, simply because of her East Asian looks and because she was wearing a mask.
Right.
And I think there was a certain amount of prejudice early on,
right.
That people just automatically assumed that if you looked as if you were from the Far East, you must have COVID.
Right.
Did you encounter anything like
Now I had a bit of fear in terms of there were a lot of hatred and negativity against basically Asian looking person wearing a mask. In society in general,
yeah.
So I was quite wary of that.
Mm.
But I have to say, in Oxford at that time, Oxford itself is a very unique place. You never really find. I think discrimination is very not tolerable in Oxford itself.
Mm.
So I felt safe in a sense of being Asian.
Mm-hmm.
As a baseline, and I was also like just fully focused on like trying to scan patients, so I wasn't really quite wary of that. But say if I have sometime that I actually check about the news, I was worried that say if I go outside of Oxford, I will get discriminated, I might get hurt, I might get, you know, stabbed somehow. Yeah, but it was really just concern in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily I had experienced any of that. Mm-hmm. No, so I didn't experience any of those hatred or like racial discrimination. So it was lucky, actually. I was really lucky at that time in Oxford.
And was it hard being a long way from your family when this was going on?
It was hard, yeah. Mm. It was.
Although I think Taiwan managed the pandemic pretty well.
It was managed really well. So in Taiwan, wearing a mask isn't necessarily something that is just for disease. You know, it's not like you wear a mask because you had a cold, you catch a flu or something. No. Wearing a mask is fashionable. It's cool. It's cool to do, and it helps to like block out sunlight, to like keep your skin a little bit better, or like make your face look smaller. So it's fashionable. Like, and it's really really acceptable. So yeah, you wouldn't worry about wearing a mask there at Taiwan, and that's probably why it's actually so easy to control. To control the disease back in Taiwan. And then another thing is we didn't really get vaccine early on, and the whole country understand that like it will probably be really challenging for Taiwan to get vaccines production manufactured, being available to administer across the whole country, just because of some, you know, like global, you
geopolitical
know, geopolitical issue. Yeah. Yes, so yes. The CDC was very very aware of that, and therefore like these type of policies in terms of like being social distancing was pretty much just obeyed by the citizens itself.
So you weren't too worried about your family?
I wasn't really worried about my family. I wasn't really worried about my family because I knew that they would control it properly at that point of time. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't get, now that I recall, they have had like 4 doses of vaccine until they actually get COVID. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they were really lucky to an extent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was hard to be away with family. But also because I had experienced things like very early on, I was able to explain to them of like how people respond in terms of symptoms. So it was in a way it like. Nice as a topic to talk about, you know what I mean? to like communicate with
my
parents.
Some expertise, so
I had some expertise.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I became popular within my family group when it comes to COVID, yeah. Otherwise the whole family was just like the only thing we talk about is just about food. There's finally another topic we can talk about. Yeah. Mm.
And what was your, what was your living situation in Oxford? Were you in a shared house or were you by yourself? Or?
Yeah, I was at the beginning I was living in with just one other person, and that was my landlord. And then I decided that like, no, I need to move houses because it's not really nice to be living in that situation. So I moved to further down the road and having a house share with another 4 people, and that was also just happened to be what I could afford at that time. So yeah, I moved into that house, and I made them aware that like, hey, I'm part of this COVID study, and they were okay with it. And in fact, another person of mine, another housemate of mine, she was the vaccine researcher at that time. So yeah, it turned out to be really really nice that I joined that house, and it was also a really good decision because during the period of a very isolated time in COVID, we as a house were very supportive towards each other. One of the housemates, he worked at the board game cafe, so we will have the opportunity to play board games at home. So it was a very good social support at that time.
Mm.
So living situation was okay.
Mm.
I was careful most of the time, just trying to clean up before I get back home.
Yeah.
And they were really considerate. I was really lucky.
But I mean, the work itself, you said, was intense and quite stressful.
Yeah.
Do you think the fact that you were working on something that was important, that was contributing to our understanding of this mm-hmm. disease, help to support your own well-being?
Yeah, certainly. I think that was a special thing to do. I think that was a very impactful thing to do. Yeah, and I knew it. Not everybody will be part of this experience. And I was in a way now looking back really proud that I had made a decision to stay. Honestly, yeah. Mm.
So I think we're nearly at the end now, aren't we? Keeping an eye on the time. Has your experience of working through the pandemic changed your attitude or your approach to your work and your plans for the future?
Probably yes and no. I think unconsciously it did change the way that I work. I became really flexible and became okay with things going wrong. But no, because I really wasn't early on in my career. I knew that there will be changes. So yeah, I guess it's a yes and no together. I have to say, regardless, it was a good experience to have. Although, like, it's a huge part of my 20s gone socially, but like it's good to for my early career, I would say. So.
And I should have asked this before, really, but you've now had an experience of what it's like working in a commercial company.
Yeah, it does.
But also in academic environments.
Yeah.
Which way do you think your career will go in the future?
Will go in the future. I'm leaning more towards at a corporate setting and at a industry setting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, more leaning towards that. And actually, this is not necessary because it's not necessarily because my experience in perspective changed the way that I think. It's probably because that's just my nature as when I, growing up. Because I knew I am someone who really liked to get engaged with people, talk about like big stuff, talk about like impactful stuff, and had the opportunity to really make things like come into play. That's just probably based on me personality wise and strength wise. Mm. I think industry will be a good fit for me. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.